What's it like to work undercover as a CIA intelligence officer? This hour, we hear from an Iowa State University graduate and 34-year veteran of the CIA. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tom Twetten retired in 1995 after working for the CIA since 1961. When he retired, he was the CIA's Deputy Director for Operations. This evening, he's speaking in Ames about the ethical implications of intelligence work.
You can't just send out an American young boy or girl who says, "I'm an American, let's be friends."
The past, present, and future of espionage, a first-hand account. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What's it like to work for the CIA? To be a spy? How has work in the field of clandestine operations and intelligence gathering changed over the past half century? And what are the ethical considerations of being a Central Intelligence Agency operative? These are a few of the questions we'll explore this hour with my guest, Tom Twetten. Twetten worked undercover as a spy for decades and eventually became a spy master. He's an Iowa State University alumnus and veteran of 34 years in clandestine services for the CIA. He worked under diplomatic cover for the CIA in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. He was deputy and then chief of the Near East Division in the 1980s. He then served 6 years as the chief of the clandestine service as CIA's deputy director for operations. Twetten was twice awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Medal. That's the CIA's highest intelligence award. Tom Twetten will speak at Iowa State University this evening at 8 p.m. It's open to the public, and his presentation is titled Ethical Implications for the Intelligence Community. It's part of Iowa State University's World Affairs series, Redefining Global Security. Tom Twetten joins us this hour. Good day to you, Tom Twetten.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with some of the points you'll no doubt be touching on in your lecture this evening. Ethics, of course, a big focal point of much of the news and the controversy about intelligence gathering practices since 9/11. Torture, the NSA warrantless surveillance controversy. What points will you be wanting to make in your talk this evening?
Well, I think I'll try to put it into perspective. Ethics in American intelligence has been a point of dispute and discussion since Nathan Hale chatted with his friends about whether he should accept George Washington's invitation to spy on the British in New York City. And he finally decided himself that even though he was a gentleman, it was necessary and that necessity trumped morality in his case. And he went off to be a spy. We have a statue of Nathan Hale in front of CIA because he's an honorable man and the first American to have given his life in the service of his country while spying. That carries on to the time after 9/11 when we had the largest trauma in our nation after the U.S. Attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. It was the largest trauma since Pearl Harbor, 1941. Mm-hmm. And it was a national crisis, and the president and the National Security Council reacted to that by telling CIA to take off the gloves, to get more active, and to go at the terrorists, capture them, interrogate them, kill them if need be, but eliminate that threat.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about torture, if we could. Specifically, in December of 2014, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee released its five-year review of CIA documents, and the report concluded that the CIA misled the White House and the public about its torture of detainees after 9/11. It acted more brutally and pervasively than it acknowledged. And this is based on the study of millions of pages of CIA documents. It concluded, for instance, that the Central Intelligence Agency failed to disrupt a single plot despite torturing al-Qaeda captives in secret facilities between 2002 and 2006 under George W. Bush. Now, I know your time in the CIA is not this time. You were in the CIA between 61 and 95. How did this happen with your perspective? Give us a clue on how we could be so misled, and not only us, but our elected officials.
Well, I think I would have to respond that the Senate Democratic Party report led by Dianne Feinstein is a sad chapter in the history of oversight. That it is not a fair report. It did indeed look at thousands and thousands of documents. They were cherry-picked to include those documents that supported the final report that torture had not been successful.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that is that if you want to do a review and you want it to be fair to those who were ordered by the Justice Department and the White House at the time to take these measures and were given very specific guidance on which techniques were legal and which were not, then what you have to do is interview the people that were involved. And you have to interview the presidents who were briefed. And you have to pull back the members of Congress who were briefed more than 60 times on the details of this program. And then you write a report. And the Feinstein report didn't do that. It only did documents. And so they got the answer they wanted. But it isn't a fair answer for the American people to look at.
Mm-hmm. Enhanced interrogation, that is what it was referred to as, even though we call it, some call it by that name, it is indeed torture.
Well, my old colleagues, I can tell from the press, are still arguing about that. In my personal view, it was torture. And the president, President Obama, in 2008 said, that was torture and it defames the American values and we aren't going to do that again. And that made perfect sense to the CIA. They got the message. So then you have to ask, well, why did the Senate decide to do a review if it's already decided and CIA has gotten the message? And the answer to that is the Senate has a legitimate oversight responsibility. And if you had a bipartisan review, including both the Republican members and the Democratic members, then you could expect a fair report.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the Republicans did not like the terms of reference. They didn't see how it could be a fair report the way that Feinstein was planning to do it, so they opted out.
Ethics aside, and I want to ask you about that in a moment, but is the intelligence community, as an observer who has been in the CIA for decades, previous decades, is the intelligence community divided over the question of whether torture yields accurate, actionable intelligence?
I think this was a one-off problem, meaning that having had the crisis, having responded by, in my view, going a little too far, and I know some of my old colleagues who were ordered to do it don't agree with that, but I think torture or the techniques they used, some torture, maybe some on the edge, went too far. And I don't hear any vibes that anyone in the intelligence community disagrees with that now. They all have a message that political leadership says we aren't going to do that. I think you could argue, I wouldn't, but I think it's possible that you could argue that Dianne Feinstein's report is ethically good because it does say we don't want to ever use torture again. And even though she went too far in the way she went about it, I think she is interested in having as her legacy the value of being more anti-torture than anybody else.
If you've just joined us, Tom Twetten is my guest this hour. He's an Iowa State University alumnus, but also a veteran of 34 years in clandestine services for the Central Intelligence Agency. He worked for the CIA from 1961 to 1995, eventually ending up as a so-called spy master. Are CIA operatives given training in ethics, Tom Twetten?
More so now, I believe, than they were when I joined. I was brought into an agency that was really quite young. It had values and leadership from people who were in the OSS wartime. They were accustomed to Nazi and Japanese atrocities and during the war, and they knew from their experience that anything that defended the nation was valid. That's changed a lot. And yes, there are some ethics trainings. I don't really know the extent of them, but it is my suspicion that the best book on ethics and intelligence is required reading for CIA trainees. Mm-hmm. And that book is written by an Iowa University graduate, Jim Olson. He's also a graduate of the Iowa University School of Law. And the title of that book is Fair Play. I recommend it to your listeners.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, when you describe that, is it that it used to be CIA operatives were just told, do as you're told, where now they're, are you as an operative or a lower level person in the field allowed to raise ethical questions as they arise?
Well, it's even trickier than that because what you start with in CIA is an effort to recruit the best and brightest in America who have a moral compass, who already know right from wrong. And you can't teach that after they arrive at the agency. It's if you want the best intelligence world service in the world, which I believe America still has, you want very high-quality people. And it's my belief that CIA still has that. So ethics starts with that. Then when you take a young case officer who is meeting with an agent and comes in face with a moral dilemma, and he's out in Africa or Asia somewhere, he's alone, and he sometimes has to make a decision without anyone else to help him find the guidance. Mm-hmm. There are other cases in ethics in which headquarters does have a chance to weigh in, and if it involves something that is unethical, it's usually referred up to the highest levels if it's a serious problem that needs to be resolved.
I know in your decades of work at the CIA, there are probably countless situations you are not permitted to tell us about, but I wonder if you can recall and share a situation you were in which you faced a moral dilemma.
Well, let's see. I was very much involved in the covert action program that assisted the Afghan people after the Russians invaded their country and killed everybody in the presidential palace in December of 1979. The Pakistanis went into partnership with us to support the Afghan Mujahideen against the Russian army. And it wasn't initially a war that we thought we could win, but we felt if there were young Afghans who wanted to fight, they deserved our support and we should find weapons for them. There came a point in which they wanted us to provide silenced pistols for assassinations, and we declined. We didn't think there was any way that we could trust how those pistols would be used and against whom. Mm-hmm. And we did not want to get into the assassination of individual Russian officers in downtown Afghan streets.
And yet we did provide them, the Mujahideen, with Stinger missiles, which eventually became used against the West.
Well, not quite. We did provide them, certainly, and that was, in fact, the silver bullet that won the war. And we were very much afraid that they could be used against civilian aircraft or against the West by other people who could go into Afghanistan and buy those weapons. We spent a lot of money over years and years getting those Stinger missiles back. But I know of no instance in which one was used against the West.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the recent announcement by current CIA Director John Brennan announcing his plan to overhaul the agency by creating what he's calling mission centers, concentrating resources on specific challenges or geographic areas. Help us understand how that is different than what we have now.
What we have now mostly is geographic divisions of operators and then parallel divisions of analysts. And they have been separated, one on one side of the building and one on the other side, forever, since the founding. That broke down in the 1980s when the Counterterrorism Center was formed, and that brought some analysts together with operators. It brought in a couple of FBI people. Brought in some NSA SIGINT officers from another agency, and it worked. It's been a model. It's grown to be possibly the largest component within the agency. And what Brennan is doing, and I think it's probably a very wise thing. I don't have any personal contact, but it looks to me like he's taking that model and putting the analysts and the operators and the technical people together. Mm-hmm. One of the big challenges that I sense in his discussion of this is the problem of hacking and the breakdown of the possible breakdown of the digital world, in which U.S. Agencies, our electric grid, nuclear facilities are all under pressure from foreign governments who are trying to gain entry by brute electronic or digital force, and this is a serious threat, probably more serious than the Middle East ISIS is, to the American well-being over the next decade or two. Mm-hmm. Brennan is trying to get ready.
Well, you were involved in recruiting, finding, also directing the finding of agents. How do you go about that? Well, what are the keys?
I would describe it as an art form, that you look for people who have access to secrets, foreign secrets that cannot be acquired by any other way. It revolves around the assumption that foreign leaders are lying to our leaders, that there are secrets that they want, especially the U.S., not to acquire. And those are the ones that the human operators of CIA go after. They spot who might have access. They assess those people who might have access. And then they attempt to find ways to meet them and become friends and to persuade them to provide that information to the United States. It is illegal because, in the sense that all countries have laws against espionage, and we are asking agents of foreign countries to commit espionage on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. What are the most effective tools you have in recruiting a foreign agent or getting information out of someone? You said befriend them. What else can you do to get the information that you feel they have for you?
I think it becomes a question of understanding the individual and understanding his weak points and his aspirations for the future, and then developing a scenario. That's when the art form comes in. It's like writing a play that utilizes that assessment of the individual. There are a fair number of cases where we also get critical information from friendly governments' intelligence services. That's called liaison. And there are also some wonderful cases of defectors, people who volunteered to us and trusted us with their secrets when they were unhappy with the policies of their own governments, especially Russia.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. Fascinating conversation with Iowa State University alumnus Tom Twetten. He worked undercover as a spy for decades and eventually became a spy master, a veteran of 34 years in clandestine services for the Central Intelligence Agency from 1961 to 1995. We'll be back in just a moment with more. We'll ask him how he began, how he became a CIA agent, and also what they're looking for in agents when they recruit them here in the United States. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. With more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking today with Tom Twetten. Twetten worked for the CIA for 34 years, from 1961 to 1995. He worked as an intelligence officer and then became a leader in the CIA, serving in the end as a chief of the clandestine service as the CIA's director for operations. Let's talk, if we could, Tom Twetten, about how you became a clandestine agent for the CIA. You graduated from Iowa State University in 1957?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. What is the path then from there to becoming a person who works in the CIA?
Well, most of us at that point were members of the Reserve Officer Training Corps. I was in the Army, and so I had 2 years of Army service to do, and I took my new wife to Germany, and we served in the U.S. Artillery for 2 years there. When I finished that, I was anxious to find a job that would get me overseas and engage in being with foreign cultures, and that was derived from my interest in both history and psychology. I went to Columbia University and got a master's degree for 2 years in international affairs, and then I looked around, decided that I indeed wanted to be out in the real world, not in academia. I wasn't real sure that I'd be good in academia. And so I applied to the State Department and joined the CIA. And I think I joined there partly because of the aura of not knowing very, very much about it.
Oh.
And there was much less information available about the CIA.
What did training involve?
Training was really interesting because it involves a lot of scenarios. Back to this art form I talk about, in which training officer takes on the identity of a potential recruit. And over a period of time, you as a trainee are responsible for finding ways to become in contact with this alleged agent and to recruit him. And the training officer would sometimes put huge hurdles into the path. So it was like a real Cold War scenario. It was all very anti-Russian of USSR, and it included being rousted in the middle of the night because there was a coup d'etat in the country you were involved in.
As part of a training exercise.
As part of a training exercise, that's right. And it was really quite effective when we got out into the world, a real world.
Can you tell us about an action that you were part of, an initial reaction maybe in the 60s or 70s that you saw made a big difference in terms of national security?
I can recall an instance in which I by that time was the chief of the Egyptian branch, and this fellow named Henry Kissinger had successfully found a way to talk the Egyptians and the Israelis into a peace negotiation. A part of the American support for that included providing the Egyptians with the same kind of technical collection capability, meaning SIGINT and ELINT, electronic surveillance, out in the Sinai Desert, in order to give the Egyptians the same capability that the Israelis had. The Israelis said, fine, that's part of the peace process. The Egyptians said, we'll take it. And Henry Kissinger tasked us, which meant me. I wasn't a technical officer, but I was put in charge of making sure the program worked. And we galloped off to build a bunker facility for the Egyptians and to train them. We were told to hop right to this by a very forceful Secretary of State, Mr. Kissinger, and 90 days later we reported back that the equipment was in place in the Sinai Desert and training had begun. And he said, tell me that again. And so the director, I wasn't there in the meeting, repeated it, and he said, You know, nobody else in the U.S. government has finished their feasibility studies on what to do and how to do it, and you guys have already finished. And it did make a difference.
You later, toward the end of your career at the CIA, which ended in 1995 when you retired, you directed in the 90s intelligence resources in support of new democracies in Eastern Europe after those peaceful revolutions. What were the major challenges for you at that time?
We were very concerned that the Russians might try and roll back this new democratic capability in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Poland. They were all very anxious to be new friends of the United States. We started out doing some training on these things, and then I said, wait a minute, this really isn't covert, and we want to be very careful not to taint any of the Democrats who are so eager and full of life out there in Eastern Europe. So let's turn this over to our overt friends in the State Department. And we did that rather quickly, rather than doing something that we were being asked to do by new friends, but which did not really fit our charter.
Tom Twetten is my guest. 34 years he worked in clandestine services for the Central Intelligence Agency, an Iowa State University alumnus. Is it true that you were involved in making the first U.S. government purchase of a Predator drone?
Yes.
When was that?
Well, let's see. That was fairly soon before I retired, so 1993. Yes.
So in 1993, was it clear they would become as important when you purchased that first Predator drone as they've become today in intelligence gathering and operations?
I had in mind a small drone that would be able to loiter over something for up to 24 hours, and I had in mind that it would be in countries that didn't have a radar or didn't remember how to turn the radar on and connect it with a weapon to shoot it down, which is most of the world. And it would be low-tech, and it would be an intelligence resource for the community, not just for CIA. And Jim Woolsey was the director, and he happened to know the right man who was a former Israeli who was actually working on such a thing out in California. And since he knew the guy, I was out in California 2 weeks later and was impressed with what I saw. It was an early version of what became the Predator. What happened afterwards, I might be referred to as one of the initial sparks, the other one being Jim Woolsey. The second, the next thing that happened was some very smart technical people in CIA and in the Air Force rigged up a mechanism by which we could communicate from the intelligence in the new Predator through American satellites that already existed and back down to Washington.
That was a key.
And that was the key to making the Predator a revolutionary intelligence source. It was used within in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia within two and a half years after my initial oral contract, which is an astonishing achievement for the American intelligence and military people who were involved to bring something from essentially the drawing board into actual use in that short a period is unheard of. It was a capability that was overdue, and I think that's why it went so quickly, because I had seen the Israelis using drones very successfully in the summer of 1982 against Syria. So it was hard to figure out why the U.S. didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. And the reason really was that the U.S. Air Force was not enthusiastic. The U.S. Air Force is led by fighter pilots. They see no reason to have something in the air that doesn't have a fighter pilot flying it. And it was a cultural thing that it took them quite a while to get over.
Tom Twetten is my guest. We have about 10 minutes left of our discussion. Tom is a veteran, 34 years in clandestine services for the Central Intelligence Agency, retiring in 1995. Also, he got his undergraduate degree at Iowa State University. Let me ask you briefly about becoming a clandestine agent. What are the personality traits that best suit the work?
Well, I think that moral compass I mentioned is one important factor, and there are some questions in initial interviews that try to get at that. Another attribute, I think, is being a people person. You have to like talking to people and engaging them in what life is really like for them, and especially with foreign cultures who have a very different framework than we Americans have. A third attribute, I believe, is integrity and understanding that even though you're being asked to suborn foreigners and have them break their laws and breaking their laws yourself, that your oath to defend the Constitution of this country includes the necessity to be truthful and to be legal in your actions when it comes to American law. The other part of it is the human side of finding and recruiting agents still remains. It's much harder for some targets, like finding an agent who will tell you what ISIS is up to in the middle of the Syrian desert. That area is denied to us, and you can't just send out an American young boy who or girl who says, "I'm an American, let's be friends."
Right.
It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned when you went into the CIA in 1961, you didn't have a very good idea of what it actually entailed. What sort of lifestyle should someone be prepared for going into the CIA?
Well, I think it's quite an adventure. I thought so at the time. I loved my career because I thought it made a difference. And I liked the idea that every day was different, that you were working on different problems, and that your next assignment to a very different country meant that you had a new challenge to learn all over again the essence of the people and the culture and how that country worked and what was important about that place to our country.
In your personal lifestyle, you worked undercover. What did you tell? Who knew who you really were? And what was the cover story you gave to people in the neighborhood, for instance?
Well, I think it's pretty well known now that I was under State Department cover most of my career. The only problem I had with being a distinguished member of the Foreign Service, allegedly, was that people eventually started asking why I wasn't an ambassador. That included my mother, who, bless her soul, was puzzled at why I didn't advance more quickly.
Tell us, because a lot of our conceptions about the work that you did come from movies or TV shows. Which ones in your lifetime do you think give the most accurate portrayal of clandestine work?
I like Argo because that does tell a story about CIA exfiltrating State Department officers who were under great threat from the Iranians right after the Iranian Revolution. And it was a brave and risky operation which succeeded. Hollywood liked making it because it makes Hollywood look good. They provided the cover and the mechanism by which we were able to get these people out. Tony Mendez, who was the documents technical officer who went to Tehran at great personal risk to himself, is a real hero for having rescued those people. The other one that I like is Zero Dark Thirty, which I think accurately portrays how awful this question is on torture, and eventually gives you the message that of how hard it is to find somebody like bin Laden, who most certainly did not want to be found in a Pakistani town, and was successfully found and was taken out, was assassinated by a U.S. military unit in a superb operation that was led by CIA.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing James Bond is on the other side of the scale as far as inaccurate portrayals.
Yes, that's about as far away from the real world as you can get.
You worked in the CIA under, my counting is right, 8 presidents: Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, and President Clinton. How much does who the president is matter to how effective U.S. intelligence is?
Well, it matters a little bit because Bush 1 had been the director of CIA, so understood the people and understood the missions and understood the limits of what CIA could do. He was probably the best of the lot, in my experience, at using intelligence wisely. Clinton had a much harder time because he had a Vietnam War era bias against CIA, and it took him a long time to figure out that CIA could really play a role that would benefit his presidency. He got it eventually, but it took some time.
Mm-hmm. What is your read on President Obama and the intelligence community, his relationship with them, his impact on that?
Well, again, I don't have any direct information, so I'm an informed citizen to tell you that my sense is he, too, learned in the first 6 months what the agency could do. He learned it primarily because the current director of CIA, Bremer, was close to Obama in the election campaign and was an advisor in the White House in helping him find what CIA could do and what it was not capable of doing.
Mm-hmm. Tom Tweddon, we've almost run out of time. I want to ask you, in closing, looking back on your 34 years in the CIA from 1961 to 1995, what do you say is your proudest achievement?
Well, it was a great honor to be the head, the chief of the operations officers, and there were any number of ways in which they made a difference under my leadership. The Eastern European support of the Eastern European new democracies being one, helping the Afghan people throw the Russian invaders out of their country was another. And I think I'll stop with those two mild boasts.
Okay. Tom Tweddon, thank you very much for talking with us this hour. Iowa State University alumnus, veteran of 34 years in the Central Intelligence Agency. Tom Tweddon will be speaking at Iowa State University this evening at 8 p.m. His presentation titled The Ethical Implications for the Intelligence Community. It's free and open to the public, part of Iowa State University's World Affairs Series, Redefining Global Security. Tom Twetten, it's been a wonderful hour. Thank you very much for giving us your experiences and your insights.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.